This is about the conversation that you have with people, which brings them awareness about different culture. And that's where you break the barrier.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This season delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we'll meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. This is Season 3, Episode 3 of Her Story with Asha Bart. This is Her Story. Welcome.
Thank you.
Asha, when we met, which was just a few minutes ago,
yeah.
I very excitedly told you that I had a good friend who grew up in Karnataka, which is the state in India mm-hmm. that you're from. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about what it was like to grow up in Karnataka in India.
So Karnataka comes in south of India. So I was born in Bangalore, which is the capital of Karnataka. And then my father moved to a town called Dharwad. And then he used to work for agriculture university. So from the age of year two, I grew up in Dharwad. And up to my post-graduation. So with my childhood, I was born to an academic family. My father was a vice chancellor, but my mom was stay-home wife. And she pretty much looked after us, you know, our needs, our education, you know, like, you know, whatever we wanted. And she is a role model for me. But my father was very strict, you know, he was all about education. So we used to go to school and come back home and pretty much back to study. I didn't think, you know, I did a lot of work, but other than helping my mom sometime when we had a lot of guests. He grew up in a disadvantaged family, so he knew the importance of education. He had his master degree in Ohio University in America, and he did his PhD in Delhi. So he was very intelligent man. So that's what he wanted for the kids too. Even if we did get 90 marks or 90%, we were afraid to talk to my dad because he would ask, you know, why did you get 100 in mathematics? But he supported our town. They used to come and stay with us and continued their education because Dharwad, the town, was known for education. So they used to come and stay with us. So it was not a nuclear family for us. You know, we had a lot of people growing up. Also, you know, a lot of relatives come and stayed with us when they had to do paper valuation for year 10 or year 12. So it was like always we had guests. We didn't know like what time somebody would rock up. My mom had to prepare more food.
Mm-hmm. Just in case.
Just in case if somebody rocked up. So I finished my bachelor degree in Dharwad. And when I was in a final year, my father passed away in 1991. He left a legacy for us to continue his achievement and success and stuff. So that's an inspiration for me, like even today where I am, you know, because of his legacy. And it just passed down to the generations too, because even though I didn't push my son, we have only one son. I didn't push my son because he has seen all the, like, you know, mother and father and uncle, you know, everyone is in very high position. So immediately it puts pressure on our kids too.
And it sounds like the people that you had visiting your home as well were also in pursuit of education and valued education. Mm-hmm. Did that have an influence on you becoming a teacher when you first entered the workforce?
So I was married to a scientist and he was in rural remote area where there was not much opportunities for me. I had my post-graduation in mathematics and I couldn't find university close by. So I was a stay-home mom for some time until my son went to his kindergarten at the age of 4. So I joined the school, same school, and then, you know, continued my, was contributing you know, my mathematics skill. And I worked there for 1 year. And then I started my own tutoring classes. All the top students used to come to me from year 7 up to year 12 because, you know, they found expertise in me. And then they have done really well in terms of mathematics, you know, coming to my tutoring and stuff. And by tutoring, you know, I was able to look after my son too at home. Yeah.
When did you and your husband make the decision to move to Australia?
We started our preparation 2 years before we migrated to Australia. My husband was having some rough time at work and we wanted the better opportunity. He was scientist at Indian Council of Agriculture Research. He was researching on cocoa. So we started our preparation. I've got my sister in Sydney. She sponsored us. So we moved to Australia in 2004. You know, we as a family, we came on a permanent resident basis. And we landed in Sydney. My sister initially supported. We stayed with her until after 3 months, you know, my husband found a job in his line of expertise in Adelaide in South Australia. And then we moved to South Australia in 2004 itself towards the end. And then I found a job in 2005 in February. I didn't have courage to be a school teacher because it's totally different compared to India. So I wanted to do something in that line. So I joined a family-owned, family-oriented company. Was a biological fertilizer company where my husband was working too. So I joined as an administration assistant and I grew from there.
How are the two systems different? Teaching in Australia is totally different from teaching in India. What are the differences that you see?
I think there's a lot of discipline in the school back in India and teacher means, you know, it's like a god over there, and there's a lot of respect, and I don't find the same respect here. It's totally different. Found that, you know, I couldn't do it here. I was always interested in administration too, back in India as well, and I think, you know, it runs in our blood. You know, my father was a vice chancellor, so I wanted to try something different. Wanted to work with numbers, but something different, and it worked out really well. I get good support from a manager in BAE Systems, where I worked in Adelaide too, in a big corporate company. And then he encouraged me to go for master degree in accounting. And from there, you know, I finished my master degree in accounting. So there are some men models too for me to prosper and success in this country.
Recently went to speak at a school in Albany where you live now. One of the reasons behind that was to talk about anti-racism and what this means. How did you approach that talk that you gave, knowing that there are differences in the ways that schools operate?
Yeah, so it brought out my own trauma, that what I experienced when I first landed in this country. Like, it's totally different, cultural shock, hundreds of job refusal, even though I had the master degree. So it all comes back to prejudice. So I touch base on prejudice. We all have prejudice, but we are here to learn and discover that and, you know, go forward about that. So it brought me trauma completely, but then, you know, I knew that I was chosen to do that talk because I'm a perfect person, that, you know, that school, you know, embraced diversity. And then I saw a lot of students there, you know, from different cultural background, and I gave importance that, you know, English is my second language. And I have Indian accent. We all do have accents, different accent. It could be Australian accent, American accent, and Indian accent. We all do have accent, but we need to embrace our differences and then respect each other, be kind to each other. Diversity brings a lot of opportunities as well. So I addressed about prejudice that we have and how do we look, you know, reflect on that and learn from it and grow from it.
As the CEO for the Southern Aboriginal Service, has this understanding of what it means to be anti-racist grown over the time that you have been working there, or did you come into the role with this idea of approaching it in this way?
Well, growing up in India, I saw a lot of disparity and disadvantage, and I wanted to do something, but I didn't have the tools. When I started working for Southern Aboriginal Corporation, and I felt, you know, I had a sense of belonging straight away. I grew within the organization, and in 2013, when my organization had a lot of crisis, they appointed me as chief executive officer. I had to bring a lot of accountability and integrity into the system and had to implement two restructures. Since the organization has grown to the next level, one thing I do within my organization is talking about the discrimination, the diversity that we need to embrace, because we have staff from different cultural background too. And at the same time, you know, recognition for First Nation people. When there is issue, if somebody says something as a First Nation person, as a staff member, I make sure that, you know, it's not being personal. You know, they come with a lot of trauma. So we understand and acknowledge that and sit with those staff to understand deeply the trauma that they are going through. And when you understand that trauma, it's easy to deal with that. But at the same time, you know, I make sure that, you know, every other nationality, every other culture are respected within the workplace, because we are all working towards one common goal. This is about supporting the First Nation people to achieve their potential.
Was there ever any pushback on your appointment from the Aboriginal community regarding someone who is not First Nations doing the role of CEO?
I took the CEO role from my predecessor, who was an Aboriginal lady. Initially, there was no pushback because, you know, I showed a lot of improvement within the system. But then later on, I realized that, you know, this organization need an Aboriginal CEO. So I have received some pushback. It's not that I didn't receive pushback. Pushback from not from Aboriginal people, but also from non-Aboriginal people too. It isn't easy, but my board is very supportive of me, and they know why they have recruited me in this position. What I'm doing within my organization is, you know, bringing the next generation leader, making sure that, you know, you're training somebody who can take that role. So that's what I'm doing, because it's not easy to find somebody who is expertise in everything. So I have expertise in finance, expertise in business. Many a time I felt, you know, I shouldn't be the CEO of the organization. But again, you know, it is about talking to leadership team and talking to the board and reassuring yourself, you know, you are the right person to do so. Being neutral is sometimes really good. You know, I'm not taking any sides. I'm talking to all families. Sometimes, you know, there could be division within the Aboriginal community. But, you know, to me, you know, supporting everybody, every family member. So that's what I initially learned, that, you know, family are interconnected. I can't talk to one person and say, hey, no, this person is like this, because I don't know their connection, right? So that's what I learned very quickly in the beginning. So it's supporting all the family. That's why we are there. You know, we are the lead Aboriginal corporation in the region. So being neutral is sometimes brings positivity. There are, you know, negativity in every position and everybody. But, you know, we need to embrace that and then go forward.
You have chosen with your partner to live in Albany. What has it been like going from these places, which are not close to the beach, very dusty, out to somewhere which is on the coast and usually very windy and very cold?
This is Albany, right?
Yes.
I love Albany. I call it as home. My husband from Adelaide went to Kununurra, but I stayed with my son. And then within 6 months, he moved to Albany. He was there for 3.5 years, and he went to Central Australia when our son was in high school. So I stayed in Albany with my son. Then my husband came back after 3.5 years to Albany, stayed for 3.5 years. And then now he's in Geraldton. So it hasn't been an easy journey for me. So I've been single many times, supporting my son with his study and sporting needs and all. And now he's a doctor, so working in Fiona Stanley. I'm very proud of that. I felt like, you know, I gave stability to my family, but my husband has been traveling everywhere, changing jobs, changing project. It hasn't been easy. It has had impact on the relationship too sometime. You know, I kept hearing in the past that, you know, like couples, you know, who are doing this FIFO job, you know, they have impact on relationship. And I quickly found out the reason, because when my husband is away, I have to be completely independent. And when he's back, you know, then your routine changes. It's not been easy at all. And especially a woman who was very dependent back in India, I did not even travel with overnight journey without anybody, to come to Australia and learn driving, learn to be independent. It has taken a lot of toll physically and mentally. It has not been an easy journey at all.
Do you think you could have done the role that you're in? Do you think you could have been CEO of this organization if you hadn't developed those skills in independence?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is positive that I have, but, you know, I came to Australia in 30. It has taken toll, you know, when you're in that age, it's not easy. It's not like, you know, in 15 or 20, you make changes. But in 30s, you have a young son, you have to start from scratch. If I hadn't have those skills, definitely not, I wouldn't have been the CEO. So I'm really happy that whatever motivated me has taken me to the CEO role.
What do you think did motivate you? What do you think it was that you were able to adapt to, not only to a new culture, which can be such a shock, but also to having your husband live away from you for years at a time and be a single mother and be apart from your own family of origin? What is it about you that has made that possible?
What I observed even in my childhood, you know, I was very compassionate about even the workers. I saw, you know, the power control sort of thing, and I didn't like that. So I saw that disadvantage back in India too, and coming here and just, you know, learning about First Nation people, the disadvantage they have gone through and they are going through even now has motivated to me working more and more for First Nation people. And what I don't like is injustice. I didn't feel anything back in India about, you know, those sort of injustice.
Even though you had these injustices, you were able to see them and the disparity between people when you were growing up in India, it sounds like you were able to recognise it intellectually, but when you moved to Australia, it hit different on an emotional level. Yeah. That gave you the motivation to continue working and continue developing to be able to work in the area.
Australia is a multicultural country. Back in India, we're all one, Indian. So coming here, you know, I became a minority. I started look at, you know, people's body language and try to pick that too. And look at, you know, injustice and disparity, disadvantage here, you know, that motivated. And Aboriginal people, you know, allowing me to do that work is a privilege for me. So they have accepted me. They have allowed me to be a leader of the organization, which is an organization which is standing for 40 years now. It's outstanding. An Aboriginal community-controlled organization to be standing that long is outstanding. It's because I see that, you know, it's not an easy work. The work there is very complex. We work very hard, we tackle very hard issue, family and domestic violence, suicide prevention, issues about the youth, health promotion, housing. These are all disproportionately affect Aboriginal people. It is so hard, and the funding is not very long, so you're continuously battling for funding every year. That means, you know, you're not stable, giving stability to your staff. So you see a lot of staff leaving and going into another organization. But the criticism that we get is like, oh, you have a lot of turnover of staff, not knowing the intricacy of what is happening inside. And you have to give that support to staff because they are tackling very hard issue. And the trauma that comes with people's story that, you know, that affects staff members. And if you can't provide that support, you can't go forward.
Vicarious trauma is hidden negative impact of working in communities and working with vulnerable people. How can we ensure that the same people who are working in community are not going to be the next generation or the next kind of cycle of people who then need support?
We provide training. There is fantastic training from VALI, who are a New South based an organization, and they do City Hack, culturally integrated trauma-informed healing approach. So all of our staff are trained in that area. Just having training means nothing because, you know, staff feel that on an everyday basis. We provide employee assistance program, and that's not enough, but we need to check with our staff and making sure that, you know, there is support for them, they do self-care and those sort of things. It hit them hard sometime, and some people have gone to part-time, and we allow that.
We touched a minute ago on funding. I imagine as CEO, a massive chunk of your time is taken up with grant applications and then grant acquittals and then reports outlining the ways that you have reached your KPIs for that quarter. How can a not-for-profit become stable in this environment of short-term funding that is reliant on statistics around outputs, so like how many people you've seen, rather than the outcomes that you're achieving for those people?
It's continuous lobbying with the funding body and the bureaucrats. So that's my job every day. And people see me everywhere in the photos, talking on radio. That's when people think I have nothing to do but just being in the photos. And that's not true, though. It's not just being
but
in
Asha,
the photos.
But Asha, you have such a beautiful face.
Thank you.
In all the photos.
Thank you. But these days, you know, like funding body have realized and they are changing. And some of the funding bodies are providing 5 years. 5 years of support, so that helps a lot. But at the same time, you know, we need to look at how we are supporting staff and rewarding too. And that's not easy because all funding bodies are not providing CPI. So without the CPI and the cost of living going high and high every day, if we don't provide competitive salary for our staff, they're going to leave the organization.
CPI is when the salary goes up in line with the price of inflation, right?
Yes.
So they can provide funding, and at the beginning of 5 years, it can be like, I'm working for a not-for-profit, I suppose I can't expect like heaps of money. But by the end of that 5 years, you're still working and it's now below what it takes to be able to live a good life.
So when funders ask, you know, if I give you $2 million, what do you do? I first thing I say, you know, I look after my staff. I provide more money, more wages for my staff, and also want to have external debriefing for our staff so we can look after them. So that's the thing that I say all the time. But if we can't provide competitive salary, they're not going to stay. But I'm not providing rest salary. We are providing more salary every year. That means, you know, the funding for the programs will be less. So these government, federal or state, they need to look into that because we are purchasing the services for them for at very low price. And if the government has to do the same work, they will be working at very high rate.
It's also an indication of what we as a society value and we as a society are willing to spend our money on, right? Because You're saying that you're providing to the government a service at a very low price.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a service that looks out for First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
If we're willing to go for like the lowest possible price for this service, then it says something about how little this society values the health and welfare of First Nations people.
It is. And very recently I've heard many things about the funding going to Aboriginal community. Not everything is going to Aboriginal community at all. You know, a lot of funding is going to government and mainstream organization. I would say if it is to do with Aboriginal people, it should go to Aboriginal community-controlled organization because they know their community. They have Aboriginal staff who are able to provide that support. It's not easy. I'm seeing every day, I see clients coming to our office. They're coming today. They're not able to disclose what's happening with them, so you have to build continuous trust with them. So this is the quality of work that we provide, not the quantity. And if I look at mainstream organization and their data is completely different to our data because they might have seen 50 clients, we would have seen 20 clients, but the quality of work that we do on a daily basis can't be ignored. And there is no measurement for it, you know, how we do that qualitative sort of work.
One of the other things that I've come across is the reasoning mainstream organisations can sometimes give is that, oh, well, we've tried to work with this community or this community and they're just not interested. And there seems to be a willful blindness to the fact that maybe the reason that this community is not engaging has something to do with the service.
I think mainstream organisations are specialised in some area. In some areas, you know, they have expertise. If they are providing service to Aboriginal community, they need to come and sit with Aboriginal community-controlled organisation and have a genuine partnership. When I say genuine partnership, you know, it has to have 50% ownership. It shouldn't be tokenistic sort of a partnership. So that's what we think, you know, like, and in 4 or 5 years since the partnership, and they should be able to support ECHOs to take the full ownership of that. There are many ECHOs who are capable of doing all the work that currently mainstream are doing, but they may not have expertise, they may not have resources. So I think that government needs to put some sort of condition that, you know, if you are providing service with another ECHO, and then in 5 years, you know, you need to be able to transition that, you know, ECHO can do their own job.
What's the transition plan? How is that mainstream organisation, which may have these specialist skills and knowledge, going to build the capacity
mm-hmm.
of the Aboriginal controlled organisation to be able to deliver those programs themselves?
Yes. There are some really good organisations. They have approached me and we are working with them. These are mainstream organisations, have genuine passion for First Nation people. They are happy to work with us, build our capacity, and have that transition plan and exit plan. I commend them. But there are other organizations, you know, who are comfortable getting that money but not coming forward to work with ECHOs. ECHOs is Aboriginal Community Controlled Organization.
So you've gone from Karnataka
mm-hmm.
to WA.
Mm-hmm.
You're in Albany as the CEO mm-hmm. of the Southern Aboriginal Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find ways to connect with your own culture and connect with Asha, the person, not Asha, the CEO, volunteer extraordinaire?
I've made a lot of friends in the community, and when I get asked by ABC Radio sometime, you know, it's not about Asha as the CEO of the organization. Asha as a community member, because I'm a mad fan of AFL too and cricket. So sometime I get asked to come and talk in the studio about AFL and cricket. That is Asha as a community member, not as Asha as a CEO. that gives me a lot of pleasure and satisfaction, because now I have gone from Asha as an Indian lady to Asha as an accepted community member in Albany. So that's very satisfying for me.
Is Kinjali in Albany where you hope to retire? Is that where you are now? Is that home?
I think it is a premature discussion for me, because my husband is in Geraldton at the moment and my son is in Perth. I am feeling a bit lonely sometime, so I keep myself very busy, but I don't know in the next 5 years where I would be. Wherever I go, like, I can't forget the work that I've done in the last 15 years for Southern Aboriginal Corporation on a paid basis and on a volunteer basis to support the Aboriginal community. Wherever I go, I think I'll be looking to the growth of the organization, what they are doing, and how even I can contribute externally to. So this has given me a career.
So, Asha, you have come to work in Albany, mm-hmm. which is a regional town in WA that is at least 4 hours mm-hmm. from Perth. Mm-hmm. If you've got your foot to the floor, which you definitely shouldn't, it's about 4 hours. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges of being a CEO in a regional town?
I see a lot of opportunities in Perth, a lot of meetings and opportunity to be on the committee where I can contribute. But I can't come. I can't commit to myself to come here. It's because, you know, we are far. Regional women are just as smart as metro women. We are capable. We lack in resources. For me to come to Perth, you know, I have to invest in traveling. I have to invest in accommodation. It's extremely hard, but I have spoken to my board where there are opportunities. I am coming to Perth. I am coming to Metro, making myself visible, making my organization visible. I've also been visible. I have got great social media presence. That means, you know, I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook. LinkedIn has connected me with many leaders. Many people know me through LinkedIn. So I have not only raised my presence, but my organization presence too. And that's not easy, being in regional area. But I can say that it's not impossible to being in regional area. If you have been active on social media, you can connect with the world.
What are some of the ways that you feel that Australian culture is connected to the rest of the world?
With my Indian culture and working in an Aboriginal organization, more so that I see similarity in terms of working in informal ways. Like, you know, when I work with the Aboriginal community, I don't do PowerPoint slides and all, sit around in a circle, have a yarn and feed and those sort of things. That's what we do back in India too. And when I look at loss and grief, you know, we have so much similarity. When there is loss in the family, there are thousands of people come, and I see that in Aboriginal families too, everyone gather. So there are similarities in those way. With the Australian culture, I think we are all human beings, and we're all human. We come from some sort of culture. So it's about the kindness, you know, what I see with Australian people, you know, they're kind. Even though there is still a lot of work to do in terms of racism, but I've seen in a lot of Australians are very kind and accommodative and have accepted us.
I know that you have been active in the Yes 23 campaign. Mm-hmm. We're talking now in, you know, the first few days after the referendum and the no result. Mm-hmm. What impact has that no result had on both the community that you're working with mm-hmm. and the organisation that you are CEO of?
Our organisation was the first to come out in the Great Southern Region to provide the support for Yes campaign. We've done a lot of campaigning. both on social media as well as, you know, like doing activities out and about in public. The community is hurting. Majority of First Nations people in our area was supporting the yes vote. The community is hurting, you know, it's like, you know, our responsibility now that to bring them together, take that out of the chest, and then see a way forward. So we are looking at getting all the community leaders together who have supported yes, and see, you know, like how we can support them and that keep that momentum going to fight for First Nation people recognition. How is going to happen? We don't know yet. You know, we will be guided by the elders. So I'm waiting for that opportunity to talk to them. But I think, you know, the community is hurting because they feel that, you know, they have been rejected and there is no recognition for them. But I think at the same time, I want to recognize the effort of 80,000 volunteers in Australia who have come forward to walk alongside of Aboriginal people. So that is one step that we have taken ahead, that many more to come. And I think we are stepping in right direction, and this moment is going to take us forward.
So those 80,000 people, those 80,000 individuals have volunteered their time towards the Yes 23 campaign. You've also committed a lot of volunteer hours over the years, and you have cited volunteering as being very important to your paid work, but also to you as an individual. You're currently the chair of the Albany Family and Domestic Violence Action Group, and also the volunteer leader of WA for women's charity Share the Dignity. Mm-hmm. How has volunteering shaped who you are as a person and as a leader?
So I was the past chair for Albany Family and Domestic Violence Action Group, but currently I'm the WA team leader for Share the Dignity. Volunteering helps in different ways. It helps you to build your network. When you are new to the country, you can't be just with your group. You need to go and learn about Australian culture, different people, how they operate, who they are. Being in a small town in Albany, it has been easy for me. We are a close-knit community back in Albany. But at the same time, you know, it gives awareness for other people who we are too. And this is about the conversation that you have with people, which brings them awareness about different culture. And that's where you break the barrier. Being a leader of Share the Dignity in WA, I've learned a lot how the volunteers work, how passionate they are. At the same time, in terms of my leadership skill too, it has developed, and I could have insight of other organizations, how they are leading and then how they are supporting the volunteers. And I was able to take that back to my organization in my own leadership and to improve my leadership too.
Thanks to Asha Bart and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make Her Story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. Join us next week when we meet an entrepreneurial geneticist who is guided by her belief in giving back to her community.